Opening credits. A Marriage Below Zero by Alan Dale, Maidmark Publishing Audiobook Edition. A Marriage Below Zero by Alan Dale is a republication of a work first published in 1889 and now in the public domain in the United States and other countries where the term of copyright has expired. Narration provided by Wondervox. Introduction. I suppose I am rather frivolous. I believe in the voice of the majority to a certain extent, and it has announced my giddiness and superficiality so frequently that there is nothing left for me to do but succumb to this view as pleasantly as possible. I never listen to the minority in any of the social questions with which I am confronted. It would therefore be inconsistent to pay much attention to its estimate of myself. Butterfly-like, I flutter about in society, living in the all-sufficient present, reckless of the future, and absolutely declining to recollect the past. I have a mother who loves me a great deal more than she did some time ago, when I seemed to tacitly insist that she should grow old decently and gracefully. Now I do my best to assist her in her vigorous struggle for perpetual youth, and she is thankful to me. She appreciates my efforts. Ah, it is good to be appreciated sometimes. I really don't know what I should do without you, Elsie, she says in an occasional outburst of good nature. You are such a comfort to me. You make me feel as though I were your sister. Sometimes, I think I am. So you see that her affection for me is by no means maternal. I call her mother, from force of habit, though, accustomed as I am to the word, it often sounds rather ludicrous in my ears. Conventionality forbids me to use her Christian name. People have always had pronounced prejudices in favor of what they call filial respect, and a quarrel with conventionality is generally fatal, as I have learned. So we trot around to receptions and kettle drums and dinners and dances as mother and daughter. I would willingly pass for the former if it were possible to do so, but it is out of the question, unfortunately for dear Mama. I shall never leave my mother. We shall continue our trot about the social world until one of us is obliged to give in. I hope I shall be the first to fall because, like the little boy in the song, I could not play alone. I am convinced that my mother also hopes that she will be the bereaved one. She enjoys life so much that I cannot blame her. My demise would necessitate her withdrawal from society for a year or so, but Madame Pauline, in Regent Street, really furnishes such delightful mourning that, as Mrs. Snooksley Smith said to me the other day, it is positively a pleasant change to wear it. Mr. Snooksley Smith had been gathered to his father's a few months previously, so that I know she spoke from experience, poor, lonely widow. I wear a wedding ring. It is concealed beneath a scintillating cluster of diamonds, which I have purposely placed on the third finger of my left hand, but it is there. I hate it. It is in the way. If I thought I should ever marry again, I would make it a point of insisting that the lucky man should despise those little golden badges as much as I do. I must wear mine until I die, I suppose. You see, everybody knows that I am Mrs. Ravener. All my friends seem to take an ill-natured delight in emphatically using my married name. I may be as frivolous as I choose, as recklessly flippant as I possibly can, but my wedding ring must remain. It does not upbraid me for my conduct. Not a bit of it. I have a perfect right to do everything in my power to forget it. I would fling my ring to the bottom of the Thames and still maintain my unquestioned right to do so, but, ah, there is always one of those detestable little conjunctions in the way. I hope I am making you wonder what all this means, dear reader, because I intend tearing myself away from Mama for a little and devoting some time to you. You say you would not like to inconvenience Mama? Oh, you need not hesitate. I shall tell her that I need a little rest and shall interpret her surprised, "What nonsense, Elsie," into a motherly injunction to take it. She is still a little afraid of me, you see. She remembers that, like Mr. Bunthorne, I am very terrible when I am thwarted. Though nothing in my behavior nowadays indicates that I have the faintest suspicion of a will of my own, Mama knows better. Perhaps in the solitude of her chamber, she wishes that dear Elsie were the sweet little gushing non-entity she appears to be. In time, I may make her forget that I have ever been anything else. Perhaps as she grows old, if she ever does, her memory may be dulled. It is just possible that she may pass away in the fond conviction that her only daughter has never crossed her will. Who shall say that I am not charitable? I am going to write the story of my married life. I intend to open old wounds by confession, which, it is popularly said, is good for the soul. The task may do me good. A little taste of bitter recollection can but enhance the value of the sweet vapidity of my present life. I can pause while I am writing, if I feel at all overwhelmed by the flood of reminiscence, which will pour in upon me by the gates which I voluntarily open, to congratulate myself that it is all over forever. Like the little girl who used to get out of her nice warm bed and make her sister call out, "There are mice on the floor," so that she might have the pleasure of rushing back again and huddling up under the clothes in an ecstasy of comfort, I will recall the past, in order that I may enjoy the present all the more. Perhaps that present palls upon me sometimes, though no one guesses it, and I hardly suspect it myself. Possibly it needs all the contrast with the past that I can give it, to render it endurable. I say possibly, you know. I wish to be consistently frivolous. You will be able to remember these remarks when you have read the record of the events which I am about to chronicle, and when you close the book, say with a sigh of relief, "Well, in spite of all, she is living happily ever afterwards." Chapter 1. No, I shall not weary you with a long account of my childhood and all that sort of thing. When I read a story, I always skipped the pages devoted to a description of the juvenile days of the hero or heroine. They are generally insufferably uninteresting, or interesting only to the writer, and I can find no excuse for selfishness with such a weapon as a pen in one's hand. My mother was left a widow when I was a baby. There is a mournful sound about that piece of intelligence which is absolutely deceptive. In reality, it was a most satisfactory outcome of what I was always told was an extremely unhappy marriage. I heard that my father was a charming man, well-read, intellectual, courteous, and refined. His death was a happy release for both. Poor Papa could not tolerate the shallowness of his spouse's hopes and aspirations. While Mama looked upon her husband as an encumbrance and an obstacle in the way of her social ambition. A husband is very often unnecessary when you are once in the swim of society. When he has given you the protection of his honorable name and endowed you liberally with the goods of this world, why, the most delicate thing he can then do is to cease reminding you of these facts by taking himself off. At least that is the way a great many people look at the matter, I am told. I was a year old when Papa died. What I was there for, I cannot imagine. There was absolutely no reason for my existence. My mother despised children from the bottom of her heart, or, I might more aptly say, the place where her heart was supposed to be. But I thrived on my bottle. I grew disgracefully fat and outrageously healthy, and it soon became apparent that there would be no difficulty in rearing me. The only person who could have felt any satisfaction at this was my nurse, who, without me to take care of, would have lost a good situation. I have promised to say little about my childhood, and I will respect my promise. I was packed off very young to an extremely aristocratic school, where for years, dear Mama left me to myself, pursuing her own sweet course in the labyrinthine mazes of society. She paid my bills regularly, and they were pretty big ones, for nothing that could make me subsequently interesting among Mama's dear friends was neglected. I was to go into society very young. I think she wanted a little excitement and imagined that she might get some entertainment from a nice, accomplished daughter. Everybody was aware of the fact that she had one, you see, and also cruelly remembered her real age. So why not use the girl to as much advantage as possible? So, I presume she reasoned, I was finished in the most approved manner. I was taught to play the piano with the most provoking persistence, and made day and night hideous with my frenzied interpretations of things in variations, of pyrotechnical morceau, and of drawing room selections. I sang songs with roulades which would have frightened Patty, and effective little chansons with plenty of tra-la-la and tremolo about them. Creatures on whom the education I received would be likely to take effect ought to be caged up, as dangerous to the community, in my opinion. I spoke villainous French in order that I might vulgarly interlard my sentences with an occasional Gallic expression. I have done so above. You have Madame Beaubichon, instigated by Mama, to thank for it. A long-haired, beery German was going the rounds of the drawing rooms at this time, I ought to say salons, I suppose, and talking the gullible Londoners into the belief that he was a musical prodigy. I was taught German, I presume, in order that I might be able to tell him, in his own language, how much I adored him. I was very accomplished, in a word, desperately so. I will say this, however, I despised my education. I could see through its superficiality even then. I enjoyed my school days thoroughly. I liked the society of the merry, laughing, giddy girls I met. Towards the end of my finishing period, I went home for a holiday, and the return to school was simply delightful. I dreaded the idea of leaving it for a home which I knew I should detest, and for a mother in whom I had not the faintest interest. At 17, however, I was taken into the bosom of my family, and the happiest period of my life came to an abrupt end. I remained quietly at home for 3 months before I became that silliest of human beings, a blushing debutante. She doesn't blush long, poor thing. I had one dear friend whom I regarded as a sister. Letty Bishop had left school 2 years before I emerged, so that when I was ready to burst upon the social world, she was already a full-fledged society girl. I shall always remember the ball Mama gave to introduce me to the world. It was a great event for me, an absolute and utter revelation. I rejoiced at the idea of meeting my old school friends and of resuming the pleasant relations we had enjoyed without restriction. I was also particularly anxious to become acquainted with members of the male sex, of whom I had heard so much from my friend. I knew none, except John, the butler, who I cannot say impressed me very favorably. I supposed that men were nice, sensible, jolly beings, immeasurably superior to girls, and with so many more privileges. They could marry whom and when they chose, I thought it at least, and had unlimited power over creation in general. I hoped in my heart of hearts that I should soon be chosen, and that some young man would carry me away from Mama to a life which would be more endurable. As I just said, that ball was an utter revelation to me. I was going to rush at the dear girls I knew, gushingly glad to meet them again after such a long separation, and burningly anxious to take them off to indulge in those nice long talks we had at school. But when I saw them in my mother's house, I hardly recognized them. Could it be possible that these affected, fragile creations were really the same girls who, only a few months ago, had surreptitiously purchased indigestible cakes, openly read sentimental novels, and enthusiastically sworn eternal friendship the one for the other? Why, they had no eyes for anything female now. All their attentions seemed turned in the direction of the men. They greeted me with chilling politeness and turned from me with ill-concealed haste to salute members of the other sex. Of course, I had no doubt that they were as eager to meet men as I was. Still, I was not prepared to be treated in this way. If the behavior of my feminine friends surprised me, I was completely astounded before the evening was over at that of the other sex. Why, it was impossible to talk sensibly to these men. They made silly speeches and showered compliments upon me in a manner that simply caused me consternation and hurt my self-respect. I could not imagine what they meant by being so personal. It would have only been after years of familiar intercourse that a girl would have ventured to talk to me, as did these men, whom I had never seen before, and with the utmost assurance. It seemed to me that when strangers gave utterance to such ridiculous remarks, they were guilty of nothing less than impertinence. When they were not unpleasantly self-satisfied, they were absurdly bashful. No girl is ever so contemptuously ill at ease as a bashful man, for whom I have never been able to feel any compassion. One of our young hereditary legislators asked me to dance, and willing to put him at his ease, for his arms seemed to embarrass him, and his blushes amounted to a positive infirmity, I consented. He seemed to me to be a foolish young peacock, one of those men who Carlyle says attain their maximum of detestability at 25, and ought to be put in a glass case until that period, after which they are supposed to improve. He danced well. I have since learned that most social peacocks do. The poetry of motion seems to accompany lack of brains. When once my lord had disposed of his arm around my waist, he was another being, oh, so much improved. When the dance was over, he led me into the refreshment room and brought me an ice. I needed it. I had danced boisterously because I was young enough to enjoy the exercise for itself alone. I could have passed a much pleasanter time, however, had my partner been my one friend and confidant, Letty Bishop, than I had done with the gawky arms of young my lord encircling my waist. "What a delightful waltz," sighed my lord, as he watched me greedily eating my ice. He was no longer embarrassed. My efforts had been successful. "Yes," I replied, "I love dancing, and I think you waltz nearly as well as even Miss Bishop, that pretty girl sitting over there." I pointed to a chair where Letty was reclining, surrounded by, I believe I counted, 17 young men. I thought I had paid him a great compliment. I had enjoyed my dance and felt in a better humor. My lord did not seem at all elated, however. He became silent and eyed me sentimentally. "Why don't you have an ice?" I asked presently, feeling annoyed at his stupidity. "This pineapple is very good. There are real pieces of fruit in it." "Ah, Miss Bouverie," said he, "I am not in an ice humor." "Ha ha, ha ha, what a good pun," I laughed flippantly, wishing he would remove his eyes. "You ought to keep me in countenance, though. I always think people look so gluttonous eating by themselves." My lord took a chair and an ice at the same time, and sat down beside me. He spoke very little, which I ascribed to the fact that he was enjoying his ice. When he had finished, he asked me if I had any more dances to give him. I looked at my program. I had none. My lord scowled. "Miss Bouverie," he said, "you are the only girl here I care about dancing with. All these belles of 16 seasons weary me, languidly, and you give me only one meager waltz." "I think you are very rude to my guests," I answered, vexed. "They are nearly all young girls, and most of them are nice ones too. I would as soon dance with you as with anybody, but as this is my mother's party, I believe I am not allowed to choose. I must take everybody who asks me, I suppose. Not that it matters much, however," I added indifferently. "I can't see that a partner makes much difference as long as he dances well. One has no time to talk." My lord looked surprised. "You are too young," he said, with what I considered unpardonable frankness. Then, in a low tone, "Miss Bouverie, I am so glad you are now out. I shan't refuse any more invitations. I've been sending refusals to everybody lately, you know." Lucky people, I thought. I rose in disgust and left him. I felt sick at heart. I had been dancing all the evening, and all my partners annoyed me. They appeared to imagine that I was a doll and condescended to play with me. Was that the way men always treated girls? I asked myself. A long time has elapsed since that evening, but though I have since learned that a man who never says a pretty thing is an abnormal being who will ultimately sink into obscurity, I wonder that it should be so. I was completely disappointed. Even Letty Bishop seemed to view me with less interest while the men were around. She had known me longer than she had known them, and surely I ought to have been considered first. I felt that I could never like the other sex if it were composed exclusively of creatures like those with whom I had danced, under the most favorable circumstances too, namely, in my mother's house. From what I had seen, I judged that in the social world, women must be the sworn enemies of women, and men, the everlasting foes of men. Girls I had heard declare themselves to be eternal friends, never spoke to each other during the evening, and I failed to notice a man address a word to one of his own sex, which would indicate any friendly interest in it. I wept bitterly as I cast aside my fine feathers that night. My self-respect was wounded. Men had treated me as though I were a silly toy, and I had expected so much from them, and had thought they would be even more companionable than women. Companionable. Great goodness. You will probably have arrived at the conclusion by this time, dear readers, that I was a fool. If, however, I possessed no peculiarities, I should not venture to be sitting here. Indeed, I suppose I should be a respectable British matron, with half a dozen sturdy children. And, let me see, it is 10 o'clock. I might now be ordering a boiled leg of mutton with caper sauce for my little Olive Branch's dinner. Opening credits. A Marriage Below Zero by Alan Dale. Maidmark Publishing Audiobook Edition. A Marriage Below Zero by Alan Dale is a republication of a work first published in 1889 and now in the public domain in the United States and other countries where the term of copyright has expired. Narration provided by WonderVox.